This is Radio 2 on 1500 meters and VHF.
In the fifth program in the series, A Land Fit for Heroes, Kenneth Moore examines the outbreak of peace in 1918 and the effect it had on the songs that people were singing. The increased pace of a new age was reflected in the insistent post-war rhythms they were dancing to, and the newfangled gadgets like the wireless and the gramophone that they were listening to.
On November 11th, 1918, the Great War suddenly passed into history, and millions of soldiers began being civilians once again. The whole world rejoiced in a return to normal life, whatever that was. But what nobody understood at the time was that the old days were gone, and they weren't ever coming back. But the soldiers were coming back, those of them that weren't left in Flanders fields, and they, too, weren't the same fellows who'd gone to war 2, 3, 4 years earlier. Life for them had changed. They'd seen a few things, and two popular songs in particular expressed the problems of readjustment. One of them posed the problem of country boys who'd had their eyes opened by the Mademoiselle from Armentières and all those other easy-going French ladies who'd done their best to make life a little more, shall we say, enjoyable for the serving men, as Eddie Cantor explains.
You're gonna keep them down on the farm after they've seen Paris. How you gonna keep them away from Broadway, jazzing around, painting the town? How you gonna keep them away from harm? That's a mystery. Imagine Reuben when he meets his pa. You kiss his cheek and holler, ooh la la. How you gonna keep them down on the farm after they've seen Paris? Gonna keep them down on the farm after they've seen Paris. How you gonna keep them away from Broadway, jazzing around, painting the town? How you gonna keep them away from harm? That's a mystery. They'll never want to see a rake or plow. And who the deuce can polyvoo a cow? How you gonna keep them down on the farm after they've seen Paris?
Well, may they ask that question. But an even stickier problem was the acceptance by the fighting men that in City Street they would have no rank, no uniform, and would have to learn pretty quickly that what made you a success in the army didn't always make you one back home. It's no coincidence that this next song, a truculent cry from the heart on behalf of every private who ever got the run around from his superior officer, was written by a sergeant, Sergeant Irving Berlin.
I got the guy who used to be my captain working for me. He wanted work, so I made him a clerk in my father's factory. And by, I'm gonna have him rest in work. Up to his brow, I make him open the office every morning at 8. And I come around about 4 hours late. Everything comes to those who wait. I've got my captain working for me now. He's not worth what I have to pay him, but I'll never complain. I've agreed to give him $50, sir. It's worth twice as much to hear him call me sir. While I sit in my cozy little office, he's outside working hard. Out in the hall, at my beck and call with a Teleduster standing on guard. I've got the guy. Who used to be my captain working for me? He wanted work, so I made him a clerk in my father's factory. And by, I'm gonna have him wrapped in work up to his brow. When I come into the office, he gets up on his feet. Stands at attention and gives me his seat. Who was it said? Revenge is sweet. I've got my captain working for me now.
A triumphant cry by Al Jolson on behalf of the rank and file. But there were other, more profound ways in which the world had changed since 1914. The 20th century had finally arrived, and popular songs provide the evidence. For a long time before the fighting began, the latest inventions had been celebrated in words and music.
Come away with me, Lucille, in my merry Oldsmobile. Down the road of life we'll fly, automobubbling, you and I. To the church we'll swiftly steal, then our wedding bells will peal. You can go as far as you like with me in my merry Oldsmobile.
Oh, very fine. But suppose your merry Oldsmobile wasn't feeling so merry one day and refused to start. No good giving it an extra bag of oats or a kick in the rump. Those simple mechanical adjustments went out with the horse. No, this was the age of the internal combustion engine, or as it was known at crisis points, the infernal combustion engine.
Johnny O'Connor bought an automobile. He took his feet out for a ride one Sunday. Johnny was tucked up in his best Sunday clothes. She nestled close to his thigh. Things that went dandy till they got down the road. Then something happened to that old machinery. That engine got his goat, off went his hat and coat. Everything needed repair. He had to get under, get out and get under to fix his little machine. He just was dying to cuddle his queen. But every minute when he'd begin it, he'd have to get under, get out and get under. Then he'd get back at the wheel. A dozen times he'd stop to hug and kiss, and then the darned old engine, if it would miss, and then he'd have to get under, get out and get under, to fix up his automobile.
Once you'd repaired the thing, of course, you could think about some of the other boons of the modern age. For instance, being able to talk to somebody without looking at him or her.
Tommy met Kitty on a tram car one day. Vowed he was sweeter than the flowers in May. But he soon found out the pretty Kitty every day came to the city. He was engaged to answer telephone calls. So when he rang up one day, when she cried hello through the telephone, he heard her new voice say, Kitty, Kitty, isn't it a pity in the city you work so hard with your one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight Gerard. Kitty, Kitty, isn't it a pity that you're wasting so much time with your lips close to the telephone when they might be close to mine?
And as the motor car and the telephone became mass-produced, so were microphones and gramophones and wirelesses. Music began its freakish advance into the front ranks of big business, but still small business, or sometimes no business at all, if you were unknown, like ex-private Bud Flanagan.
After I got demobbed, I was round the agent's offices, naturally, in the West End, and I was crossing Piccadilly Circus one morning, beautiful morning, and as I got onto the refuge in the middle of the road there, towards Eros, I met Chesney Allen. I hadn't seen him since Papa Ringe in 1917. And I said, hello. I couldn't remember his name for the moment. And he said, hello. We sort of mutually recognized one another. And I said, naturally, what are you doing now? And quite proudly, he grabbed my elbow, walked me over to the London Pavilion, turned my back on the London Pavilion, and pointed across the road to the Criterion Theatre. And there, over the marquee, his name was... It was a farce there called You Never Know You Know, starring so-and-so, so-and-so, and Chesney Allen. I said, my gosh, you have got on, haven't you? He said, well, we've only just opened in that. And I said goodbye to him, and I thought, oh, gosh, I wish I could do that. And on I went the agent's rounds.
Well, we know how that story ended. And we know how this one ended, too, in the greatest musical success saga of the next 30 years. This most remarkable episode begins at the tail end of the previous century in Russia, where tens of thousands of Jewish refugees streamed west to sanctuary. One family in particular found it on New York's east side. And in 1919, the younger son of the family, young George, suddenly hit the jackpot. His partner in this enterprise was the lyricist Irving Caesar.
There was a big hit at the time called Hindustan. A big one step says, Hindustan, where I came to rest my tired caravan, so forth. So I said to George, I said, why don't we ride an American one-step, George? Why must it be Hindustan? Let's go home. We'll go up to your house, 144th Street off the drive they lived. And we'll sit down on the piano. We'll write a song. And we'll write an American one-step, and we'll call that song... Well, I'll let you guess what we called it.
I've been away from you a long time. I never thought I'd miss you so. Somehow I feel your love is real. Near you I want to be. The birds are singing, it is song time. The band are drumming soft and low. I know that you yearn for me too. Swanee, you're calling me. Swanee, how I love you, how I love you, my dear old Swanee. I'd give the world to be among the folks in D-I-X. I even know my mammy waiting for me, praying for me down by the Swanee. The folks up north will see me no more when I get to that Swanee shore. I love the old folks at home. Swanee, how I love you, how I love you, my dear old Swanee. I give the world to be among the folks here. D-I-X, I even know my mammy waiting for me, praying for me down by the Swanee. The folks up north will see me no more when I get to that Swanee shore.
The two men whose art is embedded in that record both played a dominant role in the development of popular songs over the next two decades. George Gershwin and Al Jolson. Well, what manner of men were they? Gershwin was charmingly vain, phenomenally gifted, a conqueror at 19 of one of the toughest professions in the world. As a child, he'd been dubbed by one of his teachers as a pianist of genius. Anyway, we'll find ourselves confronted by his saturnine good looks very many times before this series is over. But for the moment, as peace broke out once again, George was still only at the very threshold of a brilliant career. Jolson, too, was still standing in the wings of history, you might say, about to be catapulted to eminence not by a song or by a voice, but by the machinery being cooked up by the scientists. Reading through the annals of the period, you get the irresistible impression that Jolson, talented though he undoubtedly was, could be a very difficult character to get along with. Three independent witnesses, songwriter Harry Warren, the street singer Arthur Tracy, and the songwriter and publisher Abe Ullman. Between them and the sound of Jolson's voice, a portrait begins to emerge of a brash, egotistical artist, whose one saving grace was that he could deliver the goods.
I never liked him. He was a good entertainer, but I don't particularly like him as a person. That was a vogue in those days. Everybody followed him, got on their knees and sang too, you know? Usually some guy singing, they say, "Mammy, mammy," I say, "Get on your knees." Can't sing that standing up. But I know he had certain charisma in his era that I've watched him work, you know. I've been to Boston when he was in the theater. I'm just crazy about him. He used to stop the show cold.
Yesterday I heard a lover sigh, "Goodbye, only on my." 7 times he got aboard his train, and 7 times he hurried back to kiss his love again and tell her, "Tutti, goodbye. Tutti, don't cry." That cute train that takes me away from you, no one can tell how sad it makes me. Kiss me, goody, and then do it over again. Watch for the mail, I'll never fail. If you don't get a letter, then you'll know I'm in jail. Cut me, don't cry. Goodbye, goody, goodbye.
Well, Jolson was, I suppose I would term it an exhibitionist. He loved attention and he loved appreciation, loved to be appreciated and to be noticed. And instead of sitting like most people do, like most civilians do, they sit in a chair and enjoy their ride. But he was quite vociferous and he would jump up, stand up suddenly in the chair and start to wave at somebody pretending he saw somebody on the beach, or he'd be yelling to someone on the boardwalk in order to attract attention. And another thing he used to do, wherever he appeared in the theater, Jolson would not only stand in front of the theater to call attention to himself, but he loved to get into the box office and sell the tickets himself. And it was, you know, it was a conversation piece. People would talk about it, and of course every little bit helped the show that he was in.
I found my love, you never belong beside the bay. I left my love, you never belong, and I sailed away. I dream apart and Avalon.
In 1920, Jack Ellen and I wrote a song called "Down by the Ohio." Then I went to Cleveland and got Jolson to do it. Now, this is 1919, I think it was. In 1920, I'm in New York, and I renew acquaintance with Buddy DeSilva. And one of my very good friends was Lou Silvers. So the three of us take an apartment up on 74th Street in New York, and this happened to be Jolson's apartment. And in the main room was a big liquor chest built into the wall, a private bar. So we're there about 3 or 4 months, and Buddy had the key to the liquor chest, and it was getting very low, see? Oh, incidentally, that's where they wrote "April Showers," Louie and Buddy. And Buddy sends a telegram to Jolson. I think he was in Kansas City, and he said, "The contents of the middle room almost depleted. What do we do now?" 2 words came back from Jolson. He said, "Get out."
When the winds are blowing and the snow is starting in the fall, then my eyes turn westward, knowing that's the place that I love best of all. California, I've been blue, and I've been away from you. I can't wait till I get going. Even now, I'm starting in the call. Oh, California, here I am.
right back where I started from. Where bowers of flowers bloom in the sun. Each morning, that dawning bird is singing everything the sun gives. Said, don't be late. That's why I can hardly wait. Open up your golden gate, California. Here I
California, here I come. And incidentally, the banjo player on that recording and the man who wrote the words to was Buddy De Silva, who later got a much better job as president of Paramount Pictures. The singer was, of course, Asa Yolson, alias Al Jolson, famous by 1920, but still not yet at the dizzy pinnacle he was destined for. Sometimes the songs he sang overlapped with the repertoire of a very different artist. A man who'd originally come to fame through the Ziegfeld Follies as a comedian who sang, or a singer who got laughs. Nobody was quite sure which. The funny thing was that though he became one of the biggest stars of the Follies, Ziegfeld himself thought he was awful. He couldn't stand his act. He never laughed at his jokes, and he stuffed his ears whenever the music started. The artist's name was Eddie Cantor, and he typifies the kind of person whose talent caused Revue to evolve into a sort of musical comedy. A lyricist like E.Y. Harburg, Yip to his friends, defines the process.
I got through college around 1920, and popular songs and musical comedy are just beginning to take hold of the American imagination. Up to then, it was mostly vaudeville or what you would call music hall songs and popular hit songs. And then later, the vaudeville turned into musical comedy. And the people that were the great comics were used in these musical comedies to attract it, and the books were written around them.
Ma, he's making eyes at me. Ma, he's awful nice to me. Ma, he's almost breaking my heart. I'm beside him. Mercy, let his conscience guide him. Ma, he wants to marry me. Be my honey bee. Every minute he gets bolder. Now he's leaning on my shoulder. Ma, he's kissing me. Little Lily was oh so silly and shy, and all the fellows knew she wouldn't bill and coo. Every single night some smart fellow would try to cuddle up to her, but she would cry. Ma, he's making eyes at me. Ma, he's awful nice to me. Ma, he's almost breaking my heart. He's good looking. Wait until he tastes my cooking. Ma, he wants to marry me. Be my honey bee. Hurry, dear, and send for Papa. If not Pa, then get a copper. Ma, he's kissing me. ¶¶
Some idea of the influence Eddie Cantor had on the old Follies can be gathered from the fact that by 1927, the entire show was being built round him. It was all part of the great golden age of American songwriting and theatre music, which lasted very nearly up to our own day. But meanwhile, what was happening in Britain? What about blokes like poor old Bud Flanagan tramping the agents' offices, looking for work in the music hall, an area already doomed by the steady advance of the cinema? Well, the irony is that even though it was under sentence of death, the music hall was still coming up with authentic masters. In fact, it was enjoying a kind of sunset glory. And Stanley Holloway celebrates one of the most extraordinary comedians who ever drew breath, Billy Bennett.
He was a marvel, old Bill. He was great fun. What a marvelous man he was, though, too. If he made an appointment to play golf with somebody, he used to say, "No, I'm driving off the first tee at 10 o'clock, right? If you're not there, I shall be gone." And he was. If they weren't there, he should go off on his own with the caddy. And they used to catch him up. He was an old army sweat, you see. Before the First World War, he was a cavalryman. But he had a hard life then, in the good old days of riding, when he said, he used to go over the jumps. No saddle or stirrup, the arms folded over the jumps. He said, "You'd come a terrific pearl of the horse as well." He said, "They always rush to the horse first," he said. He said, "Get about the man." He said, "They could get another man for shilling a day." He said, "Horse got 30 quid. It was wonderful. The end of the First World War, he and another man in a certain village where they had a big nappy place, they were sent to clear this nappy place up, and they sold various articles, or gave them people, you know. And he said, all we came across, he said, that was left, was two big sacks of forceps and salts. And we didn't know what to do with it, he said. So one night, he said, we took it and emptied it down the well. He said, it became a famous spa after that, he said, that village, he said.
The snow was falling on it, the afternoon was cold. The same as starving family, the sticks had all been sold. And Benny's poor old mother, she was a stricken ill. He yielded to temptation and he rifled off the till.
He yielded to temptation and he rifled off the till.
It was a sinful action to sneak another's wealth, but then he only done it for to save his family's health. Oh, shed the tear of pity, oh, quell the hangry word. He never knowed no better, nor no voice of conscience heard.
He never knowed no better, nor no voice of conscience heard.
They shoved the irons across him, a coming through the door. Says he, "I only done it because I was so poor." The officer all a-trembling, he wipes away a tear. Says he, "I knows my duty, and no more I mustn't fear."
Says he, "I knows my duty, and no more I mustn't fear."
The judge looks on in anger, and the prisoner hung his head. And then his poor old mother, what was with him, up and said, "Don't send my boy to prison, it's a first crime what he's done." 6 months replies his lordship, "Oh, God help my hurting son."
"Don't send my boy to prison, it's a first crime what he's done. 6 months
to reply
his lordship, well,
God
help my
erring
son."
They takes him from the doctor and carts him from the court, not caring how his mother, the poor home, can now support. Thank God there's them in Marylebone, what will comfort her poor heart, and see her through her trouble till they meet no more to part.
And see and see a through her trouble, till they meet no more to part.
It's duff, boys. There's only fourpence in the kitty.
Dear old Billy Bennett, the great thinker who immortalized that remark, I met a man yesterday with one leg called Smith. Oh, yes, what was his other leg called? Men like Bennett were really throwbacks to the Edwardian idea of homegrown live entertainment that reflected the life that audiences knew about. Bennett went on working the halls to the bitter end, because there really was no alternative. But some of the comic singers who in earlier time would have gone onto the halls made a career for themselves in musical comedy. And that meant the American influence. In review and operetta and musical comedy, in composition and lyric writing, the American import became the thing. And in the dance hall, too, as musician band leader Chappie D'Amato reminds us.
Yeah, they came to this place where we were playing, which was Old Bond Street, and it was called Martin's Club. M-A-R-T-A-N-S. And opposite us, a band suddenly appeared about that time, January 1919, and it was the original Dixieland Jazz Band. The shock of this, we'd never seen a trombone in a band. A trumpet, one had seen a trumpet, a clarinet, and a piano, and a drum. And the front line were all standing up. And they had a saucepan in front of the band with sugar written on it. And all these things are terribly strange, and they're cut of their evening dress. The American high waist with a long, straight cut and loose bows, funny bows, very American, tuxedos, you know, not a gentleman's evening dress, and tight trousers, even in those days, and these wonderful fellows. And, of course, it became a great affinity. My father got to find out, and he's Italian, and Neapolitan, actually, and Nick DeRocca is Italian. Italian-American, Tony Sbarbaro was Italian, Emil Christian, I think his name was Cristiani, I'm not sure about that. Sweet fellow, lovely fellow, he was Italian. So in a band of five, three of them were Italian, and the great Larry Shields on the clarinet. What a lovely clarinet player. He made this Dixieland sound live as different from other bands. He didn't play high notes for the sake of playing a high note, or make a funny squeak on the clarinet if he couldn't get the note. It was all beautiful, formulated. He repeated it many times, but it fitted, and it was part of the picture to me, with the right colour paint.
The original Dixieland Jazz Band was by no means approved of in England or America when it first began to get popular. Lots of people saw in it the music of the devil, and George Robey, in a misguided attempt to be serious, announced that jazz music was a threat to the sanctity of the family. Still, as he never said which family, nobody took much notice. What is certain is that whether people approved of the band or not, hardly anybody knew what they were up to musically, as the band leader Nick LaRocca confirms.
I featured the clarinet player on top of me.
In other words,
I wove the tune. I made the tune. Shields put the lace on it, and Edward sewed it up. That's the way it was played. And nobody else has ever been able to duplicate our playing even to this day. They tell you they are greater bands than us. I don't believe it. Because I haven't heard any of them. They've all tried. Yes, they got more technical playing than we have. All our tunes was mostly impromptu. They weren't set to music or set down on the staff like they write them down. And then make signs that what they're going to do with them. They one did that. We just played from memory. In other words, it was just like a conversation of instruments. That's all I can explain to you.
Nick LaRocca and the original Dixieland Jazz Band. But the young American writers were too preoccupied with establishing a genuine American school of popular music to worry about whether jazz was good for you or not. All over America, unknown young men were writing music that before long everyone would pay to hear. Of course, sometimes the wrong words got mixed up with the wrong tune, and sometimes even the collaborators found themselves working with the wrong partner. Arthur Schwartz, soon to become famous for the songs he wrote with Howard Dietz, tells how he started off with somebody else's lyric writer and how they got a great song off to a false start.
When I was in college, I got a job being a counselor in a boys' camp. And I heard at this first camp where I went to that at another camp was Lorenz Hart, who was to become Rodgers and Hart Hart. And there was a man there who knew his music, his lyrics and Rodgers' music that had not yet been heard professionally. And he played all of these lyrics, sang them. One of them was called, I remember, "Don't Love Me Like Othello, I'm Much Too Young to Die," so on. Da-da-da-da-da-da. And I was intrigued by these lyrics. And I said, God, I would love to meet that man, Larry Hart. So this chap said, well, if you want to meet Larry Hart next summer, instead of coming to this camp, go to Brant Lake Camp. That's where he goes. He has sometimes on vacation, sometimes he works there. And go there and get a job there. So I met Larry Hart. And we wrote camp songs together. And one of the songs that you probably know, under the title of "I Guess I'll Have to Change My Plan." Well, Larry and I wrote that song, but not with that lyric. We wrote shows every 2 weeks for the boys to play in. And we put as many boys in it as possible. And I played the piano and all that sort of. And the shows would be about an hour musical plot, which was pretty silly stuff. But in this one, the leading character was a boy of about 13 or so who was not the athletic type. He was the bookish type, the dreamer type. And Larry said, let's write a theme song for him. And so we wrote, "I love to lie awake in bed. Right after taps, I pull the flaps above my head. I let the stars shine on my pillow. Oh, what a light the moonbeams shed. I feel so happy I could cry. And tears are born within the corner of my eye. To be at home with Ma was never like this. I could live forever like this. I love to lie awake a while and go to sleep with a smile.
I guess I'll have to change my plan. I should have realized there'd be another man. I overlooked that point completely until the big affair began. Before I knew where I was at, I found myself up on the shelf, and that was that.
I tried to reach the moon, but when I got there, all that I could get was the air. My feet are back on the ground. I've lost the one girl I found.
The voices of two men who represent the British and American versions of the Song and Dance Man. The British representative, Jack Buchanan, and on behalf of America, of course, Fred Astaire. Beloved of every lyric writer because of the way he brings out every syllable. Astaire was gradually becoming one of the key men of the 1920s. Having graduated from vaudeville to Broadway, he was one of the artists who inspired a whole school of young composers to produce suitable material. And that school was headed by perhaps the most gifted popular composer America has ever produced. To Irving Caesar, he was the youngster who turned in The Melody of Swanee. To Fred Astaire, he was destined to mean very much more. And to us too, because to this day, there isn't anyone who doesn't sing or whistle a Gershwin melody at one time or another.
I first met George in a music publishing establishment when you go into find material for your vaudeville act, such as I was doing at that time with my sister. I used to go to these music publishing houses, and they would give me somebody to play the piano and demonstrate a song. Gershwin was one of those boys at that time. We used to have quite a lot of fun at these things. He was a good-natured kid, and we, after a few meetings, we used to say, well, he told me one day, he said, wouldn't it be great if I could write a whole musical show, and you and your sister would be in it? And I said, oh, that certainly would be. We certainly would be happy we could do that, because he played just great, you know.